Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Bitcoin extended its biggest slide since February over the weekend, plunging 15% on Saturday after it touched a record just days earlier of 64,870. Ether, the second biggest, dropped as much as 18%. Binance Coin, XRP, Cardano, they each lost more than 12%. So crypto's price drops over the weekend has been in part attributed, in online reports that is, to expectations that the U.S. Treasury will clamp down on money laundering through digital assets. In the meantime, China has expressed its wary of the asset class. Turkey's central bank says it will ban cryptocurrencies for payments from 30th of April this year. We know the SEC is suing blockchain company Ripple for its 2014 IPO for conducting what it describes as a $1.3 billion unregistered security offering. So there's clearly a lot of confusion over what kind of force cryptocurrencies are in financial markets. And while volatility seems to be part of the whole story of the bet on crypto, if we look beyond Bitcoin, if we take a step back and look at the digital asset revolution, where are we in the cycle of change? Are we at a reflection point or a false dawn with digital assets? Joining me now is a leading blockchain and digitalization lawyer. Krishna Ramachandra is senior partner and head of corporate finance, blockchain and digitalization with law firm Duane Morris and Selvam. He's chairman of Selvam LLC, and he's a senior strategic advisor to Dentsu Sports Asia, where he advises them on esports and digitalization strategies. Good morning, Krishna.
Good morning, Michelle.
Good to have you here. So really great, interesting topic. I want to put the question at the heart of it to you, whether it's cryptocurrencies or crypto exchanges or NFTs or tokens, are we seeing inevitable outgrowths of the digital asset revolution? And where are we? Are we at a watershed moment for an industry that began a decade ago as an experiment in digital money?
Well, I think the good news for most people out there is it's not too late to get involved, because it is a watershed moment, and in my mind, the tipping point has reached. But it is a tipping point that more or less reflects the adoption of a new it's a shift in the paradigm of one's thinking, of one's ability to relate to an asset class. And so it's more of a tipping point in that respect. But in terms of widespread adoption, we are still far away from that place.
Okay, so this is an important point. If we go back to the topic, reflection point or false dawn, where are we?
I would say that the revolution has begun, because in my mind, there's a new narrative which is being drawn out by a community, and that community has made their voice pretty clear. Mm-hmm. When you look at the NFTs, and we'll talk about it later, mm-hmm. but the type of value that they are according these assets, it is a narrative which they are claiming has to have a place in the economy.
So you see this digital class revolution as one that will continue its inexorable march?
Definitely, I'm pretty certain about that. Now I've been in the space for almost 4 years now, and I've observed certainly from a legal perspective, and then increasingly more from a commercial as well as an advisory perspective, mm-hmm. that I can see the distinct change in attitudes and in some instances almost without having a choice about it. I mean, pretty much like my case, I was the original resistant fighters, if you like, against this whole revolution. Coming from the old world, thinking that this surely cannot continue and it's just a fad. Mm-hmm. But I've been proven wrong, and it's good to be proven wrong, because I've just seen the growth and the the ingenuity that really stems from some of the new protocols and projects that are out there, it's really remarkable. I mean, this generation we are dealing with is it's an extremely innovative generation, and one that has called the narrative on what the new asset class should be. Because I believe every new generation creates an asset class which they start on.
Well, you're a lawyer, Krishna. So what I hear at you know, roundtables and, you know, even casual meetups with investors of all shapes, institutional investors, you know, retail investors, people playing with a lot of money in the markets, they all say, I'm not touching cryptocurrency because all it's going to take is for nations to step up, exercise their sovereignty and say, you know, we're going to ban this. And then the party's over. So as a lawyer, do you see that coming?
Well, whether as a lawyer or as a rational human being, I think one must look at social behavioral patterns and putting aside which community will command the significant part of the electorate in many jurisdictions. I think you just need to put away the instinctive resistance that one has. I mean, I was guilty of it when Facebook first came out. You know? You know, as an IPO lawyer, I was questioning the fundamentals, and I said, you know, no way will this stock ever take off. I mean, 400 million registered user is someone who comes in within a month, and they have had a valuation of I don't know what that was then, but it was $29, I think it was offered pre-IPO, and you know, that intellectual arrogance, if you like, that I had at that point, and then to accept it and to recognize that. You know, there are social behavioral patterns that evolve, and that generation will always set the narrative. And if we ignore that narrative, it's you know, to our peril if our livelihood is dependent on that.
Interesting perspective. So I had Vignesh Sundaresan on. He's a buyer of the $69 million NFT artwork that was auctioned at Christie's, Beeple's artwork. And, you know, he drew the parallel between thousands of websites. And why is it that, you know, we're all on Facebook, though some are more valuable than others, right? There's thousands, millions of websites out there, but only Facebook has become valuable. So if we just, you know, looked at NFTs in particular, it seems that their value is tied with this concept of a metaverse. So basic question to you, Krishna, why do you think, why are NFTs worth millions?
It really is in the eye of the beholder, because it is, it's not too dissimilar to conspicuous consumerism. You know, my sons would pay $1,000 for 6 letters on a T-shirt. Don't ask me why. 6 or 7 letters.
Are they linked to football?
No. Like, for a Supreme T-shirt, for example, okay. Right? I mean, it probably takes about, you know, I don't know, 3 man hours or whatever to produce a dozen of them for $10. But they go on for so much. So if you look at the that narrative that is created from perception, and if and Vignesh is his point in case, which is really putting his money where his mouth is and stating that, look, you know, I'm involved in this universe, and in this universe, you know, we exist. And let's not forget that there's a level of escapism that will exist in these metaverses that are being created, because you know, those who missed out on the ability to buy a relatively cheap real estate at Patterson Road, for example, you know, 40, 50 years ago, would now have that ability to purchase that same plot of land, if you like, on the net, or rather in a digital ecosystem. So I think we need to appreciate how this generation is actually looking at their lifestyles, their aspirations. And if we ignore that, you know, we would start questioning everything. But, you know, I think point in case also is the fact that when that record-breaking piece of crypto art had gone for X amount of money, it had, I think, you know, foreshadowed a Rembrandt or something else for, you know, by 4 times, right? But I think it is about creating that narrative. And, you know, I'm not sure whether you're familiar with this whole meteoric rise of Dogecoin. For me, mean, I call it the Doge Collective, right? The effect that it has by allowing a narrative to be pushed forward, because that narrative, so long as it's controlled by a sizable community, will create that next standard, if you like. And, you know, we have all seen in GameStop as well, you know, to take that movement and to get that collective going. I mean, that was really remarkable. So I think we have had enough signals about what is going to happen in terms of the social behavioral patterns that we just cannot ignore it. And there's enough out there for everyone to participate in that sense, because there's so many different layers, if you like, from this new ecosystem.
Yeah, so NFTs could be photos, could be videos, could be audio. It doesn't just have to be art. So do you think...
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You expect more artwork, more NFTs to be snapped up across the board as more and more people enter this metaverse to spend time there?
Frankly, I mean, I look at the NFT assets. I mean, I'm agnostic about the asset. I'm more interested in the programmability of the smart contracts in the NFTs and to see the evolution of, you know, how they have moved on from a crypto kitty, a ERC 721 to, you know, an engine-driven ERC 1155 protocol, which allows for the programmability and the royalty feature, so that if you could, in effect, you know, go onto a platform, and that platform will allow you to purchase an NFT, which then subsequently would allow you to have a long tail or retaining interest in that asset, even after it is sold on subsequently. So that's such an interesting feature, right? It allows for the artists, for example, not to be so emotionally attached to a piece of their work, and to know that, you know, they would be recognized and rewarded, you know, along the way. And there's a smart contract to ensure that it does that. So for me, it's not so much the crypto art that everyone is remarking about, but more the fact about the increased sophistication of the smart contracts and the programmability of these protocols that we are seeing. Because, I mean, I've seen that evolution. You know, I used to call smart contracts dumb contracts, right? Because it's so hard to really figure out the breadth of the various permutations. But, you know, it's really evolved, and hats off to the engine that I created that particular protocol.
Dogecoin has seen its market value top 40 billion. So maybe let me take a step back. Are cryptocurrencies gaining traction?
They certainly are, and I think Dogecoin is a great example. I recall a few years ago using Dogecoin as the craziness of the market, when people were just issuing tokens, and as you know, the Dogecoin was literally a spoof, and the creator had, you know, at that point of time when he wanted to name the coin, looked at his dog and said, okay, fine, you know, I'll call it Dogecoin, and you know. And in those days, they were just used as an example of how anything without any so-called value would just fly if there's enough hype around it. But I think Dogecoin now represents a different concept altogether. As I mentioned, I call it the Doge Collective. It's the effect that Doge has in having a collective group of people, a large enough community, create a narrative. Because if you think about any of the other cryptocurrencies, and let's take on Bitcoin, right?
Okay.
Because at this point of time, Bitcoin has reached it's no longer a medium of exchange. It is a store of value. People are using it as and seeking to look upon it as an investment. And you could argue that Doge and Bitcoin, in a sense, represent intrinsically that same value perception, and so this is the narrative that we need to be aware of, and we cannot just simply look at old school. You use the word fundamentals, because that's exactly what I used to do, but it's all well and good to use the word fundamentals, but if you're confined by old school if you like, parameters for those fundamentals, then, you know, you are in for a rude shock. You have to look at various other factors, and I think social behavioral patterns are one, and it's something which has to eventually find its way into valuation models and matrices for regular businesses as well.
Mm-hmm. You said you used Dogecoin a couple of years ago. Is that just as a negative example?
Yeah, it was a negative example, I must say, because it was about how anyone and everyone would just buy anything that has been very successfully hyped up. And, you know, and that's something else to take note of, because you will be amazed by the sophistication and the elegance of the hype that is created through various marketing and social media channels. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the listeners should also take note of that, and ensure that, you know, they don't get, you know, taken in by this hype. I mean, my fundamental rule always to people who ask me for tips or suggestions on how to get into the space, I just tell them, look, the very first thing you do is create a wallet. Right, just get through that whole process of creating a wallet, because you then have to apply some level of intellectual rigor to understand the parameters. Right, I think we spoke about that as well the other day. You know, and I was very impressed that you've got your wallet as well. You have really progressed since we last spoke.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have artist friends who want to know how to mint their own NFTs, so I tried minting an NFT. And then I have investors who want to know which exchange to use or what self-custody is all about. Maybe we can do a whole show on self-custody, Krishna. But before that, I want to ask you about... So what is your position on Dogecoin now? Formerly negative example, now...
Right, okay, so let me be absolutely clear.
Yeah.
I'm not even commenting on the value proposition of Dogecoin. Mm-hmm. I'm just commenting on Dogecoin as a project, right? So formally, it was used as an example by me to show the madness and the lack of any research done by people to invest in tokens. And that was really during the hype about 3 years ago. But now, if you look at Dogecoin, for me, the value it represents is the principle of the power of the collective. And whether it has done its job or it remains to do it, perhaps for another 1 month or 2 months, who knows? But the reality is, in terms of how much it's going to be valued at, and I mean, you know, for it to have taken over Cardano and some of the other major heavyweights in terms of market capitalization, it's scary, because for me, it just signals, I never knew that the community that controls that narrative is so huge. And it actually is, because, you know, you have got these other altcoins that have such robust, if you like, fundamentals that have been outstripped, you know, by a project that was started off as a spoof, which has a market capitalization bigger than Fiat and Ferrari and a lot of car companies.
Yeah. All right. I want to move to exchanges, a little bit more tangible there in terms of, you know, what's driving them. At least when we looked at the listing of U.S. Cryptocurrency exchange, the largest one, Coinbase, you know, it was an interesting discussion we could get on air. After its direct listing, Coinbase, valued at more than the owner of NYSE, $85 billion in valuation on its stock market debut on Wednesday, last Wednesday. So how does Coinbase compare with Binance as an exchange, in your opinion? For the listener, we did see Binance losing 12% over the weekend. Binance not listed, but it does have its own coin. So how do the two compare?
Right. Okay. Let me start off by perhaps explaining the difference in those two platforms. One has an active strategy to build an ecosystem of users and to incentivize those users to either spread the word or to continue using their platform by stitching in the rewards, and that's Binance and the Binance coin that was developed. Now, Binance has also come up with a smart chain, which is meant to also have CeFi and DeFi wrapped into one. Now, I must say that, you know, when you look at the protocol that they have used, I mean, there were some giveaways in terms of the cut and paste that had been done. But I'm putting the protocol aside. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that if you were to take out and replace all the infrastructure protocols you have across all the projects, what projects are left standing with are essentially their users and the stickiness of those users. So it's all about community building and the ecosystem building, which even for an NFT as well, for it to be successful, it has to have a baseline community and ecosystem. And so for Binance, you have that in terms of an ecosystem of users who I feel have a different level of engagement to that platform. Now, Coinbase is just the default platform, which was regulated and licensed, and it naturally had more people, especially the newcomers, flocking to it. And you know, you're always comforted by the Binance interface. It's very simple, and you know, it is not as sophisticated. It doesn't allow as much of the other features that Binance has. But I like Coinbase because it is, you know, it does what it says on the tin, and their approach has been very clever. Because if you look at the prospectus, which I have had to do, part of a job hazard as well, pretty well written, because they have actually stated what is out there in the horizon. And you can imagine that Coinbase is pretty much now doing about 66, 67 billion as market cap. And it is just based on, if you like, a glorified wallet and a trading service. It hasn't entered the realm of DeFi, and cleverly so, because, you know, DeFi has gotten a lot of traction, but we're still early days for there to be market efficiencies and for it to be scam free. Mm-hmm. And I think that strategy has played out very well. And one thing I must add, on Coinbase's offering, mm-hmm. it was very clever. It was a direct listing.
Yep.
It was a direct listing such that they allowed the market and the community to determine the price and during the book build, which is a lot different from most other listings of tech companies, where you have the narrative controlled by the underwriters. And I think they recognize that this might be an ecosystem or an asset class and a sector which perhaps the traditional banking sectors would not have been able to give them fair value. And so they allowed the market to do it. So, you know, it's a clever strategy. And now I think what you're going to see is everyone wanting to pick up Coinbase stock, because it's not freely available. You know, if you are a regular pension fund or manager of a pension fund, and you're going to be calling up, you know, your prime broker and getting him to get you a couple of thousand lots of Coinbase, you're not going to be able to do it, right? It's not going to be available through the ordinary channels as it was in the past. So, in terms of allocation. But this time around, you just got to go to the market. So the market pricing and efficiency for Coinbase, I think, is a welcome change.
All right. On Coinbase, I should point out that there are restrictions for Singaporeans and Australians on the Coinbase platform. Because of local rules, Singaporeans can use Coinbase to make payments in cryptocurrency, but not to sell cryptocurrencies. And I know this because a listener actually wrote to me about it, and then I had to look into it myself. And, you know, maybe we'll do a show on that as well, you know, how to choose an exchange separately. But Krishna, you're coming back next week, and we're going to be talking about digital currencies and tokens. So before we let you go, what is your word of advice to people out there wading in the waters, and they want to know what they need to know before they get into this space?
Very quick piece of advice would be bite the bullet, do your research, at least just set up a wallet, and try and leave the intellectual arrogance aside and be open to learn about new behavioral patterns and just get connected to the next generation. I mean, you know, that in itself, I think, is it's a win-win for whatever you get up to.
All right. Great place to end. Thank you very much for joining us, Krishna.
Not at all. Thank you so much, Michelle.
He's Krishna Ramachandra, leading blockchain and digitalization lawyer, senior partner, head of corporate finance for blockchain and digitalization with law firm Duane Morris and Selvam, chairman of Selvam LLC, and senior strategic advisor to Dentsu Sports Asia, where he advises them on esports and digitalization strategies. He'll be back next week with me right here on Money and Me. I'm Michelle Martin.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.